Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Joan Walsh, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and CNN political analyst, filling in for Brian, who is on vacation. In 2011 and 2012, U.S. Customs and Border Protection began seeing a sharp increase in the number of young, undocumented migrants who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border without their parents. In the following years, the agency apprehended what they called unaccompanied minors in record numbers, and most came from three countries in what is known as the Northern Triangle in Central America. People from these countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, face endemic poverty and the increasing threat of gang violence. It was around the time of this record influx that our next guest, Lauren Markham, began documenting stories of children from the Northern Triangle. Why did they feel compelled to leave their homelands? What had the response been from the government, our government, that in many ways controls their fate? We talked a lot in our first segment about the Trump administration's policy of family separation and the tragedies that have ensued. This is an earlier chapter in the story. Lauren Markham's book, The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life, is now out in paperback. It tells the story of identical twin brothers from El Salvador who, as teenagers, decided to travel across the U.S.-Mexico border. They wound up in Oakland, California. Lauren Markham, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. You've written extensively about migrants as a journalist, but when you first encountered the Flores twins, Ernesto and Raul, they're the subject of the book, you were actually working at the Oakland International High School in the East Bay of California as a teacher, I believe. Can you tell us about your work there and the story of that first meeting with Ernesto and Raul?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm actually an administrator at the school. I work part-time as an administrator at Oakland International High School, which is a high school that serves 100% newly arrived immigrant youth. And my role at the school is overseeing socio-emotional programs for youth and their families who've just arrived in the country. And I had been reporting about unaccompanied minors kind of throughout the country. I'd done a story for a magazine called VQR. I did a story for Vice. We hadn't had very many unaccompanied minors, really any, at our school until all of a sudden we realized in the spring or kind of winter of 2014 that a number of our new students from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras had arrived as unaccompanied minors and had been detained. So I first met the Flores twins when my coworker, Mr. David, at Oakland International High School, the math teacher, brought these two sort of hangdog young men into my office and said, look, these two boys have missed their court dates and they need help. They had, my book opens with them sort of circling downtown San Francisco looking for the courthouse, and they missed their court appointment because they simply weren't able to find it.
Wow, it really makes you think about the one-year-olds at the border without any representation when teenagers are that confused.
Absolutely. They were 17 years old and from really rural backgrounds, had basically never been to a city before, and it was exceedingly complicated for them, let alone toddlers.
Right. I want to bring in our listeners. What questions do you have for Lauren Markham about the experiences of these young migrants? And if you have a story to share, we welcome it. Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, Lauren, your reporting coincided with this massive influx in the number of solo children traveling to the U.S., and in your book, you listed several questions that you felt was a personal imperative to answer. You wanted to know what these children were risking, whether they were really going to be better off coming here, and also whether you could take their reasons for coming at face value. Did you get the answers you wanted?
I did, and that was, again, those were the motivating questions for writing the book. I felt as though every article I wrote, instead of answering questions, just kind of brought up more questions. But I spent several years traveling to El Salvador, to southern Texas, northern Mexico, to Chiapas, to Guatemala, back and forth, and then, of course, doing extensive interviews and reporting here in California and in the U.S., and what I learned and saw was that, in fact, I really could take what these folks were telling me at face value. on a moral level, I believed them, but as a journalist, your job is to be discerning. And what I found when I spent time in El Salvador and a little bit of time in Guatemala was that the community violence there is essentially an epidemic, and it has deep and complex roots, and it is it feels at this point relatively intractable, and it is causing incredible trauma and violence, especially against young people, and that really is the primary reason that so many of them are coming to the United States.
So in Ernesto's case, he chose to flee after a dispute in which his uncle threatened his life. So how would you describe his calculations? And why did his brother Raul choose to follow?
So there was this family is from a very rural community, but they sort of, these young men were born in the wake of the Civil War, these twin brothers, and sort of came of age in tandem with the rise of the gangs nationally and in their community. So when they were reaching adolescence, gang violence was sort of entering and getting its grip on their community. Their uncle ran a business, a human smuggling business, as well as several other businesses, and he was gang protected. Essentially, one of the twins, the older one, Ernesto, the older by 12 minutes, got on the wrong side of him. The uncle got in his head that this young man had cut down one of his big valuable trees, and there were sort of a series of other things that the uncle was purportedly mad about. So there was a rumor going around town that this uncle wanted him killed. And so his calculation was, do I stay and wait to find out if this is true, or given that I know that my uncle has perpetrated crimes like these in the past, do I get out of town as quickly as possible? And so that's what he did. His twin brother left a couple of weeks later once the family sort of settled down and sort of realized that, well, if twin number one was at risk, twin number two looks exactly like him, so he too had to follow.
Right, of course. I want to note that you did change the names of Ernesto and Raul and the rest of the Flores family to protect their anonymity. You watched these boys develop into young men. Help us get to know them a little bit. What are they like?
They're wonderful young men. They arrived here, like I said, the moment I met them, they were in essentially a protracted state of shock. They had witnessed pretty horrible things on their way to the United States. I say this in the book, and it is very true. Their story is not the most harrowing of any story I've ever heard, which is saying something because their story is quite harrowing. They witnessed murders and rapes. One of them was kidnapped or sequestrado when he was moving through Guatemala. So they witnessed pretty unspeakable things and experienced unspeakable things, and then kind of were dropped off in this country, or ended up in this country and made it to California after being detained for several months, and were just trying to bump around and figure their way through an incredibly complex bureaucracy, the school system, the court system, you know, trying to find a job, trying to pay off this incredible debt back in El Salvador. So they're both incredibly resilient young men. They're incredibly funny. And when I met them, when I sort of was spending time with them in the beginning of their journey here in the United States, I saw two young men who were very much kind of young, had a young adolescent energy, right? They were concerned about girls and Facebook and soccer and cool shoes, right? They had these very adolescent and sort of young adolescent. They were 17, but they in certain ways seemed younger than 17. They had these preoccupations of adolescence, but then these very adult preoccupations where they were worried about court and debt, and they were dealing with things that many of us have never even dreamed of experiencing, that they had experienced firsthand as young men.
As I listen to you talk, I think about the way that President Trump himself and the Trump administration would take two young men like Ernesto and Raul and portray them as either MS-13 members or, you know, likely recruits. How do you respond to that kind of language and attitude about these young men struggling to make it after a harrowing experience like that?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Joan. Yeah, I mean, my experience working as an educator with, at this point, hundreds of young men from Central America, and, you know, as a journalist, having reported and interviewed hundreds of young men and women, that characterization could not be more false. I mean, as we know, and as has been well documented, not just by me, but by many journalists and advocates throughout the country and throughout the Americas and even internationally, the vast majority of these young people are leaving, as the Flores brothers in my book did, because they're fleeing gang violence. But it's also that characterization of sort of painting these young men as animals, as Trump has said, as these MS-13 killers. I mean, it's a pretty thinly veiled ploy, right? And it's a mechanism to try to dehumanize these young people. In fact, many of them have stories that the vast majority of people would be incredibly compassionate to. So to paint them as animals or as criminals or as cold-blooded killers is just an attempt to sort of strip away that compassion and dehumanize these young people so that our government can enact these draconian policies. To keep out immigrants, which as is being reported, but I feel like cannot be said enough, you know, unauthorized migration is at record lows.
Right, right. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I am Joan Walsh, filling in for Brian. My guest is Lauren Markham, author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Brothers and the Making of an American Life. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll talk to Lauren some more and also take some of your calls. I see some calls queued up already, so please stay with us. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Joan Walsh, filling in for Brian. I'm talking to Lauren Markham, author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Brothers and the Making of an American Life. We've got a few callers, and I'm going to go to Jadonia from Queens.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
My question is, once these children, the youth, have been identified as unaccompanied minors, or even those who are separated, aren't they supposed to, you know, being subject to our rules, our laws here in the United States, have guardian ad litem? They're supposed to have court-appointed advocates to speak, you know, for them, to translate, to, you know, help make some sense of it, and then to protect their own, their best interests. What happens with guardian ad litem?
Thank you, Jadonia. You know, actually, I think that our first guest, Emily Bazelon, dealt with that. There is really a kind of gray area for these young people coming here without papers, where they're not necessarily entitled to legal representation, and their representation is largely falling on the volunteer lawyers at the border and elsewhere in Oakland, in San Francisco, et cetera. Is that your understanding also, Lauren?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So not only are they not entitled to lawyers, but they're not entitled to these guardian ad litems they're entitled to them, but they're not provided them, right? So they're not provided guardian ad litem who are, you know, advocates intended to advocate for the best interest of the children. I can say, though, that there's a phenomenal organization called the Young Center that does guardian ad litem work and tries its best to provide guardian ad litems for and do this advocacy work on behalf of some of the most vulnerable individual children. Of course, they're one organization, and the need is immense.
Where are they based, Lauren?
They're based in Chicago, but they have offices in New York and in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas.
Great, thanks. So your book deals specifically with the stories of these two boys who are now young men. But obviously, we can't overlook the current situation, and we're not overlooking it, where the Trump administration has separated immigrant families who've crossed the border. And many of these families are coming from Central American countries in the Northern Triangle, as these boys did. Mm-hmm. So when you hear the stories of these immigrants being detained and their families separated, given your experience reporting on these issues, what do you think about? How do you respond?
I mean, it's hard to respond with anything besides immense outrage and deep sadness. These are people who have fled immense trauma, coming to the United States seeking protection. And when they arrive, they have been met with an intentional strategy frankly, of terror that is meant to make conditions so horrifying for them that people in the future won't come. This is sort of one of the most perverse of the deterrence through detention strategies that the United States has leaned on for years. And we have seen over years that deterrence strategies don't work. If people are desperate, they come anyway. I mean, look at what's happening in Europe. People are crossing the Mediterranean again and again and again, even though they have seen boats sink and people drown by the hundreds and the thousands, right? So if people are desperate, they will take the risk and make the journey, even if they know it to be a horrible one. So this deterrence strategy is not only horrific, I personally do not think that it's going to work. At least not in the long term.
Right. I'm going to take another caller, Annie in Manhattan. You're on WNYC.
Yes. Thank you for taking the call. I'll try to be really brief. This may be slightly off the tangent, but I wonder if your guest has any knowledge of Trump, who is in such a habit of attacking everyone and everything very viciously. It's curious to me that in any discussion I see, whether on television or here in radio in any way, I never hear him deriding the governments of these countries for the terrible things that are going on there, but rather blaming the people. And I've read many suggestions or heard suggestions of this may be due to the American guns manufactured here, the NRA, and or military machinery that is supplying the countries in Central and South America that are terrorizing them, create these gangs and using these guns and armaments to cause this upheaval. Does your guest have any knowledge of or opinion about these kinds of things that I read or hear? And is that why maybe Trump is so silent when it comes to criticizing these governments, when he criticizes everything else in the world? I'll take my comments off here.
Thanks, Annie. I know that's a lot of questions and tough questions, Lauren, but do you want to take a shot at responding?
Yeah, no problem. I mean, he has said, these countries need to deal with their own problems and we shouldn't. And sort of the general stance on immigration is sort of problems in other countries should not become our problems. They do need to deal with their gang violence. He hasn't vitriolically criticized these governments in the way he, our president, has vitriolically criticized, as the caller says, many other people and regimes, et cetera. In terms of the causes of this, certainly the more guns there are in the world, and many companies in the United States profit mightily off of gun manufacturing. The real, I think a more profound, or my research has shown that a more profound impact and cause of the gang violence in Central America is actually U.S. foreign intervention in the 80s, during this, especially in El Salvador, but throughout Central America during the civil wars there. We funded an incredibly oppressive regime that perpetrated scorched earth campaigns. We didn't only fund them, we provided them with arms, we trained their military, and we backed them when we knew that they were perpetrating horrible crimes against humanity, against especially poor villagers who they suspected to be either guerrilla fighters or guerrilla sympathizers. And we did this because it was the Cold War and we were afraid that, you know, a bunch of socialist guerrillas in El Salvador, that was too close for comfort, right? That was too close to our border. So that is the real legacy, this incredibly horrendous foreign policy in the 80s on the part of the United States. And also, directly following that, very bad immigration policy, you know, gangs were formed in the United States, as is now being widely reported, but for many years was, and I think still today was and is misunderstood. These MS-13 and Barrio 18 started in communities in the United States.
In the United States,
right. And then people were deported back to El Salvador, and they fomented there.
I mean, there's so many things people don't understand, but that's a real mind blower.
Yes.
What else do you think we should try to understand about these countries? I know you recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that the government's refusal to take climate change seriously is also driving migration from these countries. I know that drought has been a problem, especially in Honduras. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so when we talk about forced migration and sort of refugee law and policy, refugee law, which, and I should say domestically, our asylum laws in the United States are sort of, it's sort of a version of international refugee law. And refugee law protects people who have a well-founded, or who can show a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race, religion, political opinion, nationality, or membership in a particular social group. None of those five categories account for people who are fleeing environmental degradation. So there's really no international protection for environmental migration, even though environmental migration is projected to be one of the primary causes of forced migration moving forward. And an interesting thing is that it's not just, I think too often we're separating, and I myself in past writing am guilty of this too, that we think of like, okay, you know, if there's a horrible flood or a horrible drought, that's environmental migration, but gang violence, that's forced migration based on kind of political reasons, right, or social unrest. But in fact, they're much more intertwined than that, right? We can't just silo those things. And so something that I have noticed, and many other reporters and researchers as well, is that when environmental stressors are kind of inflamed and ballooning in a particular place, that, of course, sets off political unrest or exacerbates, compounds political unrest. So even in El Salvador, which has these, you know, deep, complex, horrifying challenges with gangs and with corruption and with fiscal mismanagement and all of this, when there is a drought in El Salvador, that's putting pressure on, which there has been, they're sort of just recovering from this. That means that communities are more food insecure. That means that communities are more stressed. Families have less money. And that, then where are they to turn, right? In a country where there's already so few economic opportunities, especially for young people, which is works in the favor of the gangs. If there's not enough food to go on the table, where, you know, this pushes people further into the shadows, or it pushes them out of the country to try to find a livelihood and survival elsewhere, like in the United States.
We don't have much time, Lauren, but I know you've expanded your reporting on migration beyond Central America and the U.S. To look more at how European countries are responding to the influx of migrants from the Middle East and Africa, some fleeing violence, some fleeing climate disasters and drought. It all kind of comes together. Can you talk, you did a piece for Harper's about this. Can you talk about some of the similarities and some of the differences that you're seeing?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So there are more forced migrants in the world than ever before. There are also more people in the world than ever before. But what we're seeing is it's not just that there are more forced migrants, though there certainly are. The dynamics of forced migration are changing. So it used to be that forced migration was happening, people were leaving from countries in the global south into countries in the global south. So leaving from Congo into the Central African Republic, leaving from South Sudan into Uganda. That is still happening. But increasingly over the past several years, we've seen people moving to the global north, so to countries like Europe and countries like the United States. And so there has been a real, this is partially where this nationalist kind of global rash of sort of nationalist populism is coming from, that more and more migrants are moving to Europe and moving to the United States, forced migrants, and are searching for asylum there. And that is making these countries incredibly nervous. So what I wrote about for Harper's was I wrote a piece on the kind of international border wall rash, because there are more border walls being built than ever before in this attempt, and frankly, quite vain attempt, to keep migrants out. We do know, however, that walls, whether walls of rhetoric or walls of policy or actual physical walls, don't tend to work.
They don't work.
Find a way. Yeah, desperate people find a way over or under or through or around, and they always have.
Well, thank you, Lauren. We've come full circle. We've talked about NATO and Western Europe and all this instability, but that's all the time we have for now. Lauren Markham is a journalist and the author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. I'm Joan Walsh, filling in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC.